All right, so we said that in this country, cystic fibrosis is the most common cause of bronchiectasis, and TB in third world countries. There are many other causes of bronchiectasis, and one that they like we've already mentioned, that's the immotile cilia syndrome. Another name is Cartagener syndrome. Remember the 9+2 configuration in terms of microtubules and cilia? The problem with immotile cilia syndrome is an absent dynein arm. And those nine that are on the outside of the cilia, those nine microtubules out there, they have little arms off of them. They should have little arms off of them that kind of keep them together. Those are missing. And so when those little arms are missing, those dynein arms, the cilia can't move. And so those places that have cilia that aren't moving are going to be affected. So those be sinuses, and so that's why sinusitis is a problem. Bronchiectasis, because there is cilia, you know, pseudostratified columnar epithelium that has cilia, so that's affected. Males and females are infertile, mainly because the tail of the sperm is a modified cilia. So the head is willing, but the tail is weak. Did you get that? Do you want to move? This is a sperm. Can you move? Why? Because the tail is a modified cilia and it can't. So I was saying, the head is willing, but the tail is weak, doesn't move. Okay, so that means you're infertile. I thought it was pretty clever. Most of you didn't get that, or you didn't think it was funny. I don't know what the other was, but I thought that was pretty clever, actually. Women are infertile, too. Why? Why should you be infertile? Because your fallopian tube needs cilia to carry that fertilized egg down. Okay, so it doesn't move, you're infertile. Okay, so bronchiectasis, infertility, male, female, sinusitis, and then organs being located on the opposite side, dextral cardia. Remember, that's not complete transposition. It's just a normal heart on the other side. And sometimes even organ shifts is part of that syndrome. Famous question because it gets into histology. It's a histology correlation. Okay, before we do cancer, in terms of asthma, bronchial asthma, remember it can be extrinsic, which is type 1 hypersensitivity, and intrinsic, which involves chemicals oftentimes. Many times people in the workplace get wheezing when they come in contact with a certain chemical. We already know one cause of that would be triad asthma related to taking non-steroidals. Okay, that's an example. A lot of people, especially athletes, when they run, develop wheezing, exertional asthma. That's where chromium sodium is the absolute drug of choice for that, for exertional asthma, you know, that type of thing. Sometimes cold temperatures, you know, cause asthma. Those things have absolutely nothing to do with type 1 hypersensitivity. The wheezing is due to inflammation in the terminal bronchioles. Okay, except it's going to be from a different cause. It's not going to be from smoking irritating it and causing goblet cell metaplasia. It's coming because of factors like LTC4, D4, and E4, okay, and prostaglandins that are causing inflammation are producing the inflammation and narrowing of those airways, okay, and ending up with the wheezing. Okay, that's pretty much it. Cancer. Okay, I remember on my exam, but honestly, I'm not kidding you. I remember on my exam, it wasn't this picture, it was a schematic. And the schematic had this over here, and they labeled that A, and they had this over here, and they labeled that B, and then they ask all kinds of questions about cancer. Because what it's getting at is peripherally located versus centrally located cancers of the lung. Okay. The centrally located cancers of the lungs are the ones that have the highest association with smoking, and they would include squamous cell carcinoma and small cell. So those are generally centrally located, which means mainstem bronchus types of locations. Adenocarcinomas, which are the more common cancer now, primary cancer, they beat squamous out about 2 or 3 years ago. It's kind of like 40% versus 30%. You know, it's very, very close, but adenocarcinoma is a little bit more common. They have a tendency of being more peripheral, so that as opposed to central. You want to know why it shifted? This will just blow you away. It shifted to the periphery because of filters in cigarettes. When the cigarette industry put filters in cigarettes, it took out the large carcinogens but allowed the small ones to go through, so they were able now not to be trapped in the mainstem, they were getting trapped in the periphery. So filters in cigarettes is responsible for the increase in peripherally located adenocarcinoma. Isn't that fascinating? I got that from a pulmonologist from his literature. Okay, so you can't win with the cigarette industry in any way, shape, or form. Okay, everything they say that they're going to do that's going to help you, you know, not get bad things is actually making it worse. Okay, so that's that. So centrally located squamous cell, small cell carcinoma, squamous more common than small cell, peripherally located adenocarcinomas. But remember, there's at least three, maybe four different types of adenocarcinoma. One obviously does have a smoking relationship, but actually the other three don't. And they include things like bronchioloalveolar carcinoma, had nothing to do with smoking at all. Large cell carcinoma of the lung tends to be adenocarcinoma. Scar cancers tend to be adenocarcinoma. They have real no relationship to smoking at all. But obviously, the one that is producing cancer does, because it is related to smoking. I'm going to show you some cytology guys because they think that all second year medical students should know what squamous cancer looks like with a pap smear. Now a lot of people think that the Papanicolaou stain is only done for cervical smears. No, no, no. It's a famous stain that we use on all cytologic specimens from whatever organ we get it from. And the beauty of the stain is that it stains keratin bright red. So please look at this slide, please. Okay, this, let's say, I give you a history. It's a patient that's a smoker. He's got a centrally located mass. And this is a sputum sample with stain with Papanicolaou stain. Is that red, yes or no? Yes or no? It's squamous cell carcinoma. That's all you need to know. Okay, if I said this is a cervical pap smear from a woman that's 40 years of age, what's the answer? Squamous cell carcinoma. It's in the stain, keratin in the stain, bright red, bright red. So it's very, if you're not colorblind, you will never miss this. Okay? It's very, very straightforward. Bright red cells, cytoplasm, squamous, because it's keratin. They don't expect you to be expert cytologists and know, well, that's an irregular hyperchromatic. No, 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 no. They're not interested in making you pathologists. Okay, they just want you to have that understanding that a Papanicolaou stain stains keratin a bright red. And that's going to be to your advantage. This, look at the bottom one over here. And here we can see these small cells that kind of look like lymphocytes, don't they? Okay, that's why it's called small cell carcinoma, because they're small cells. And it's a little bit more difficult, actually, to diagnose because of the fact that it's sometimes hard to tell them from lymphocytes. Okay, but these are malignant cells. Small cell cancers are the most malignant cancer of the lung. There's no doubt about that. In fact, you don't do surgery on them. You just do radiation and chemotherapy, and they're going to be dead in 3 months. They don't do surgery. Whereas the other ones, they do, if they fit a certain criteria. So these are the small cell cancers. Remember, these are output tumors with neural secretory granules in them, S100 antigen positive, the whole bit. Okay. They can make ADH, ACTH. A slightly less malignant type of output tumor that's also in the lung is called a bronchial carcinoid. It's a low-grade malignancy of the same kinds of cells that produce small cell carcinoma. So they can invade, they can even metastasize, they can produce carcinoid syndrome if they make increased amounts of serotonin. They don't even have to metastasize to do it, it just goes right into the bloodstream. But it's very uncommon, and that's all I have to say about it, actually. The actual most common cancer of the lung is metastasis. Okay, we're seeing here a lung. And this is the pleural surface of the lung, and look at all these metastatic nodules in here. We can see a little bit of cancer in here. A lot of this is around bronchi. Some of it's probably in lymphatics. But this is metastatic cancer to lung. If you played odds, what would you say? Breast. Breast is the most common cancer of the lung. Okay, so metastasis is the most common cancer. Primary adenocarcinoma is the most common primary cancer, followed by squamous and small cell carcinoma. The worst prognosis of all of them, small cell carcinoma. Okay, Horner syndrome, or Pancoast or superior sulcus tumor. Okay, these are tumors that are usually in the upper lobe posteriorly. So that's either in a posterior mediastinum, high. The use most commonly is just caused by squamous cancer in that area. And remember, what's happening here is that the tumor is locally invading into the lower part, the lower trunk of the brachial plexus, so you can get some lower trunk brachial plexus types of findings. But then you also can knock off that superior cervical ganglion. That's in the posterior mediastinum, and so you can end up with Horner syndrome. You're basically knocking off sympathetic activity, and so instead of having your lids up, your lid lags, and I think you can see, it's subtle, admittedly it's subtle, you can see that the lid is lower on this side than it is that. We of course can't tell that he's not sweating, they'll have anhidrosis on that side, and since sympathetic stimulation of the pupil produces mydriasis, it dilates the pupil, and the purpose of that is fight or flight. Remember, you want a dilated pupil to make taking as much light as you can. So if you're destroying the sympathetic, then you get not mydriasis, you get meiosis, which is not the same thing as the meiosis in germ cells. It's a different meiosis. You get pinpoint pupils. See, I have problems between meiosis and mydriasis, which one's dilated, which one isn't. But then some students said, mydriasis, D, dilate. So I haven't had a problem since. That's the one I remember. Mydriasis, D, dilate. That means the other one's the other one. Works for me, guys. You might think it's crazy, but it actually works. And every student that I teach my student that right off the bat, and boy, I get comments later on. I say, you know, that has really, really, really helped me to remember. Just remember one of two things that always confuses me, and the other one's the other one. I remember P. anca, polyarteritis. I mean, C. anca's Wegener's. Okay, that helps me. I don't fiddle with the... you may like the fact that you're treated with cyclophosphamide, and that goes with C, with Wegener's. That's fine. That works for you, great. That means the other one's the other one. But, okay, but whatever. All right? Okay, you can't really... If you came up here later, you can probably see... I'll show you how the pupil here is about this big. The pupil here is about that big on that side. So this is Horner syndrome. Pancoast tumor, superior sulcus tumor... This is the one they like for the obvious reason, neuroanatomy tie-in. Okay, with the brachial plexus stuff and then the superior cervical ganglion. They like that. Do not confuse it with superior vena cava syndrome. That's just blocking off the superior vena cava. Okay, in terms of mediastinum things, I don't have a whole lot to say about it. When we do a little muscle, I'll talk about myasthenia gravis because it does have something to do with the anterior mediastinum, and that is thymoma. And B-cell hyperplasia of the thymus. So we'll save that for then. Otherwise, mediastinal things are worthless. In terms of pleural fluid, you know the difference between an exudate and a transudate. Transudate's less than 3 grams, hardly any cells in it. Most common cause of a pleural effusion due to a transudate is heart failure. And then an exudate is a protein greater than 3 grams and has, you know, cells in it. Okay, so things like pneumonias, pulmonary infarctions with effusions, those are exudates. So you already knew that, no reason to go through them again. GI. GI is simple. There is absolutely nothing difficult in GI. Not one thing is conceptually difficult. Well, maybe malabsorption, but that shouldn't be. So it's going to be a picture show. It's going to be just purely a picture show. There's a couple comments here, a couple comments there. We should be able to get through this. All of these things you've heard before, most of them you could probably get up here and tell me a little bit about them yourself, so it's not hard. So let's start in the mouth and work our way down to the butt. I think that's a good way to go. No, I want to go from the butt and work in the mouth. Well, that's fine for you. But I'm the one that's controlling things, and I'm a dictator. Okay? And there's no negative feedback on me. Might as well make it a teaching experience. All right. Diagnosis, herpes simplex. Okay, now remember, primary herpes is a systemic infection. You have viremia, the whole bit. You have fever. You have lymphadenopathy, generalized. But then it goes away and stays in the sensory, stays latent in the sensory ganglia forever. It's dormant in that sensory ganglia. And every now and then it can come out with stress, menses, whatever. Okay? And will come out and form vesicles in the same spot, but no more systemic. There's no more fever. There's no more lymphadenopathy with recurrent herpes. Don't forget that. Remember, there's other viruses that remain latent. Herpes zoster remains latent also in sensory ganglia, and it can recur from there. So it's always there. It's always there. It can come out anytime it wants, involve a dermatome, or in this particular case, the lips, sometimes in the mouth. Okay, so primary herpes is systemic. Recurrent herpes is not. No fever, Don't let that end up with it. If we unroofed one of these things and scraped it and did a stain, we would, that's called a tank prep. We would see inclusions, which I will show you when we do GYN tomorrow. I will show you what the inclusions of herpes look like. Okay, it's a multinucleated cell with intranuclear inclusions. Why? Because it's on boards. In fact, they put it in the esophagus, as a matter of fact. They gave a picture of a multinucleated cell that was, they said, was a biopsy from the esophagus from an ulcerated lesion in the patient HIV, and it had multiple intranuclear inclusions. So it was herpes esophagitis. So that's how they did it. No problem. This is not an AIDS-defining lesion, guys, but it is a pre-AIDS type of infection, as is thrush, as is shingles. This is called hairy leukoplakia, and it's usually along the lateral border of the tongue, and it's a terrible term to have given this, because leukoplakia is a term, it's an appearance of something, and we usually like to biopsy it to rule out squamous cancer. And this has nothing to do with dysplasia. This is an infection due to Epstein-Barr virus. Okay, so it's really a horrible choice of words for this, because it gives the idea that this is a preneoplastic lesion, and it's an Epstein-Barr virus infection of the tongue. It can be treated with acyclovir. It is not AIDS-defining, but you start seeing this maybe a couple months before their helper T-cell count gets to be 200. So we see that commonly as well. Okay, this is the real thing. This is thrush. Okay, you can see that this is adult, so you know automatically this would have to be an immunocompromised patient with a defect in cellular immunity. There is no way in God's green earth that this is an adult, that this is normal. No way. Kids, of course, very old newborns, commonly get this because if mommy has candida, on the way out, the baby picks it up. And, of course, that's not a sign of immunodeficiency. They just pick it up on the way out. But you see it in an adult, immunocompromised. It is not an AIDS-defining lesion, but like hairy leukoplakia, occurs with it. This is exudative tonsillitis. Okay, what's the percent chance that this is group A beta-hemolytic strep? 30%. 70% chance it's a virus. You should have that honed into your head big time. Because many physicians, maybe yourselves, when you see exudative tonsillitis, just assume it's group A strep and give them penicillin. Boys will just eat you alive with stuff like that. You've got to prove that's group A strep. You can do it by a latex agglutination test or by culture. You just don't arbitrarily get penicillin thinking that all exudative tonsillitis is group A strep. 70% of the time it's a virus. Adenovirus. Epstein-Barr virus. So most pus tonsils are not bacteria. Now, if this was group A strep, and let's say 3 weeks later a patient went into a bibasal rails that polyarthritis and had a pansystolic murmur apex radiating into the axilla, rheumatic fever. Very good. And if I did a blood culture, what would I find? Nothing, because it's not an infective endocarditis. Okay, this exact picture, these two right up there on the boards, and it was a very unfair question. I couldn't believe it when the student said that was on my test. I said, really? And these two tongues are on your test. Yes. And I said, what did they want to know? They wanted to know which was invasive cancer. I said, that was bad. That was not good. That would require someone that has a little bit of experience with looking at things like pathologists. That was not fair, but part one. Okay, this fits the concept of leukoplakia. I see a white lesion, okay, it's plaque-like. I would try to scrape it off, and it doesn't come off. That fits the clinical diagnosis of leukoplakia. Boards will always say, what's your first step in management? The answer is always biopsy. That's true if in the vulva area or the penis area you see a white plaque-like or even reddish-white plaque-like lesion on those areas. And it doesn't scrape off. Now, a second-year medical student can get anything scraped off, but, of course, the whole penis would fall off and every other thing. I mean, see, I got it all, so this can't be really bad. Nah, look at that mass of bleeding down there. No. I mean, it's just gentle. It doesn't come off. First step in management, biopsy. Why? To rule out dysplasia and or invasive cancer. Okay, the most common cause of squamous dysplasia and cancer, you already know. Smoking, second most common cause. Alcohol, you do both, you increase your risk. This is fun, okay? Up, down on this one, okay? Which of these two do you think is invasive squamous cancer? Now, what the best thing to do is to look at the midline and see if there's any color changes or any shifts or anything like that. What is this? Is that just squamous dysplasia? Do you think that's invasive squamous, or do you think this is just squamous dysplasia and not an invasive squamous? Which one? What is this? That's invasive squamous cancer. You can see there's a color change. It's red here and it's pale there. Okay, and you can see if you follow the midline, it's curved. It doesn't go straight down there, so you know it's infiltrated. This one has a pretty reasonable straight line, has color changes the same. This was squamous dysplasia. That was invasive cancer. And that's what they wanted you to know in part one. So it's the one on the left. Okay. All right. Okay, this is the lower lip, guys. Diagnosis. Squamous. Let's put this on the upper lip. Diagnosis. Basal cell. Very good. Is chewing tobacco cause cancer? Sure. Verrucous carcinoma. And for crazy reason, it seems to have a human papillomavirus relationship, too. We had an 18-year-old in Oklahoma that died of disseminated squamous cancer because he was chewing tobacco from 6 years of age. We're redneck country in Oklahoma. That chewing tobacco was like chewing gum. I mean, it's just spitting all over the place, out the windows, on your window shield. It's just unbelievable. We call them rednecks. You always know a redneck when you have a pickup truck, and in the window in the back you see a compound bow and a gun. That's a redneck. Okay? That's a redneck. Compound, you know, ready for fighting. Okay? If you checked inside, there'd be knives and all other kinds of things in there. Okay? Never stop a redneck, because you'll get an arrow through your head and there was something like that. I mean, they are big time something. And they go 90 miles an hour this far away from each other. And you just kind of stay out of the way and let them kill themselves. That's all you do. All right. Hyperpigmentation. Diagnosis. Addison's disease. That's diffuse pigmentation in there. That would be Addison's disease. Low cortisol levels, increased ACTH. ACTH has melanocyte-stimulating properties. The very first place you see the hyperpigmentation is buccal mucosa. You got it right there. What's this, please? Peutz-Jeghers. Notice that the hyperpigmentation here is just splotchy, just little areas of hyperpigmentation. Not diffuse. This is Peutz-Jeghers right here. Peutz-Jeghers. Now, where are the polyps? Tell me where the polyps are. Exactly. Small intestine. That's actually one of the exceptions to the rule for polyps in the small intestine colon. Most polyps in the entire GI tract are located in the sigmoid colon. But the polyps of Peutz-Jeghers in the small intestine. And they're hamartomas, which means they're not neoplastic, which means that their ability to change into cancer is about zero. So there is no cancer relationship with Peutz-Jeghers. This picture's been on many, many exams, as has this one. Of course, they'll give you a little bit more history than just me saying, what is it? Diagnosis. Mumps, mixed tumor. Another name for a mixed tumor is a pleomorphic adenoma. Is this a teratoma? No, it's a mixed tumor. It's got two different types of tissue, same cell layer. It's the most common salivary gland tumor overall, and it's in its most common location, parotid. This is mumps, okay, paramyxovirus. I want you to tell me what enzyme's elevated, please. Amylase, very good. Is the incidence of orchitis high? No. And does it very commonly, if you do have it, lead to infertility? No. It's because it's unilateral most of the time. If it was bilateral, then it would be a much greater chance, but it's unilateral. Usually in older, like teenagers or adults, men, that get mumps, they're more likely to get orchitis. Can you get oophoritis with mumps? Yes, you can. And just like in males, it's more commonly unilateral than bilateral. Okay, so infertility is not usually a problem with mumps. Although they will put it down oftentimes in an infertility question in terms of, you know, risk factors. That would be way down the list. Way down the list. All right, I want to make sure you understand the term dysphagia. Okay? And odynophagia. Now, they don't actually use this term dysphagia on the stem of the question because it's kind of giving it away. They'll just say difficulty with swallowing. And that's what it means. Now, listen carefully. I'm telling you, and I mean it, because I've studied sample board questions for years to see clues. I circle things and I say, I already know what the answer is based on this. Okay, most of the time, on one side along, there's at least 5 to 6 clues on what the answer is. And so it's just a question of which one it is. Okay? They give the answer away, guys, if you know these kinds of things I'm telling you right now. If they say that a patient has a problem with swallowing foods, what is it to? Solids and or liquids. If it's just solids and not liquids, it's an obstructive lesion. Something is obstructing the food from going down. What? Esophageal web, Plummer-Vinson syndrome. That's iron deficiency anemia with chelosis, glossitis, and an esophageal web. That would be the stage of a solids but not liquids. Cancer. If you have an esophageal cancer, you will have dysphagia for solids but not liquids. But if they say that the patient has problems in swallowing solids and liquids, it's a peristalsis problem, guys. It's a peristalsis problem. That's very bad. Of course, everything's bad pretty much. If it's up here, then it's myasthenia gravis. Because as you know, myasthenia gravis affects striated muscle, and you know that the upper one-third of the esophagus is striated muscle. Okay, and then the middle one-third, combination of the two, lower one-third, pure smooth muscle. And so the lower causes of dysphagia for solids and liquids are things like scleroderma, which is better term is progressive systemic sclerosis and Kress syndrome, and achalasia. So that right off the bat, they will tell you basically what the answer is by telling you that this patient can't swallow liquids and solids. I mean, it's clearly a peristalsis problem. It's just a question. Is it up here that it's getting stuck or further on down? Up here, myasthenia. Down here, PSS, Kress syndrome, or achalasia. How are you going to separate them? An achalasia, when they go to bed at night, they vomit up the food they ate. Classic history. You don't have that with scleroderma, Kress syndrome. It will give you the other things, like Raynaud's and other things that will tell you it's that. So right off, it's very important. You can differentiate things, boom, right on down there. Palpable purpura, small vessel vasculitis. Immune complex, type 3. Odds, hand actualized purpura, most common one. That's the one they're going to do. You just think, boom. Epistaxis, platelet problem. I'm not going to think hemophilia. Are you following me? These things are just boom, 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 boom. Giveaways. Absolute giveaways. Physical diagnostic findings saying the pansystolic murmur increases intensity on inspiration. That makes it tricuspid regurg, okay? Expiration, that makes it mitral regurg. Simple little things like that they put in there that you kind of breeze over with the light, and you say, well, okay, that has nothing to do with it. Oh, yes, it does. It just gave you the diagnosis. Okay. Odynophagia means painful swallowing. That's always abnormal. What's the most common cause of odynophagia in an HIV-positive patient, please? Candida esophagitis. Is it AIDS-defining? Yes. Candida is the most common fungal infection in HIV. And when it gets in the esophagus, that's AIDS-defining. When it just produces thrush, that's a pre-AIDS lesion. That's not AIDS-defining. And candida esophagitis is the most common. So odynophagia means painful swallowing. Now I just show you pictures. Can someone focus this? I don't know. It's a little out of focus over here on this side. If you can make that clear, then I think everything will be clear. There we go. Thanks. Well, it's close, I guess. This was a piece of paper, so it got folded a little bit. Key fistula, tracheoesophageal fistula, always asked. Some andrology type of thing. You don't need all four types. You just need to know the most common one. So in a tracheoesophageal fistula, what happens, you have a blindly ending esophagus. And the proximal esophagus ends blindly. Okay, but the distal esophagus arises from the trachea. That's weird. What does mommy have? Talk to me, because that's a board question. Polyhydramnios. Now remember, amniotic fluid is baby urine. They have to pee just like you do right now. Okay, so they have to pee. What amniotic fluid is predominantly? It's baby pee. Okay, so you have to have some way of recycling it, or mommy's going to have a pretty big belly there. Okay? And so they swallow it. And it's reabsorbed in your small intestine. So if you have obstruction in your esophagus or proximal portions of your duodenum, mommy will have polyhydramnios. So, of course, you know the two answers. One is TE fistula, and the other one's duodenal atresia and Down syndrome. Those are the two associated with polyhydramnios. Okay, because they would block the ability to reabsorb the amniotic fluid, polyhydramnios. See? Okay. Also, these kids, when they eat, when they have a drink for the first time, the food gets in here, and it can't go any further, and it refluxes out, gets in the trachea, they cough and sputter. Because of the distal esophagus, it rises from the trachea, they have distension of their stomach. It's a very, very characteristic thing. Part two deals with Vater syndrome, V-A-T-E-R, part of which has tracheal esophageal fistula. They get into the syndromes on part two, not one. This is the Zanker's diverticulum, right over here. What chord is this, please? False. What about this? True. What's that? Epiglottis. What's this? Diverticulum. What's the area of weakness there that causes diverticulum? The cricopharyngeus muscle. It's a little slit in between the fibers of it, and so mucosa and submucosa. Not the whole thing. That's a true diverticulum. This is a false diverticulum. It goes out, and you get this pouch. And, of course, you collect things in this thing. You get halitosis. You could probably go like this, and everyone would die with that. It would be so bad. Okay? They have a tendency of regurgitating things, and when they do, it comes out the nose. That's horrible. So it'll be this undigested food coming out of their nose. What do you do with people like that? You run. You just run. Now, I would like this. Now, I'm going to tell you why. Because you can control it, too, because you know that you can control the food that's in there. So let's say you had a delicious breakfast. And so you just shunted some of the food into there, okay? You're hungry, and you need a little bit of a snack, okay? So you can just go, and it just comes out, and you have food kept nice and warm. What do you think about that? That got some of you awake with this hot temperature, okay. Only pathologists can think of things like that, because we think that that's extremely funny. Achalasia. Achalasia, remember, is a peristalsis problem. It's a problem with the failure of relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter. Okay. So it's a spasm all the time. Is that correct? Why? Because if you biopsy that area, you see that the ganglion cells are missing. Does that remind you of some other disease? Hirschsprung's. Ooh, that's interesting. And what was in those ganglion cells? Vasointestinal peptide. Ooh, maybe that you didn't know. Because you probably thought VIP was a very important person when they discussed that in GI physiology, didn't you? No, that's vasointestinal peptide. And guess what its function is? To relax your lower esophageal sphincter. And so when you destroy those ganglion cells, not only do you destroy the movement of the lower esophagus, but you also reduce the VIP levels, and so you have constant constriction of the lower esophageal sphincter. And so what happens is you get a bird's beak type, and this is, almost looks like a bird's beak. Maybe it rammed into a wall and it's kind of a little flattened, the beak. But whatever, it kind of comes down like this, the esophagus, like that when you do a barium study. Okay, and the proximal portion is dilated, and you get this beak-like appearance. And that's classic achalasia. Okay, so it's a peristalsis problem, the stage of the solids and liquids. Okay, I'm going to play a game with you and see if your parasitologist did a good job. There's a disease in South America where the leishmanial forms can invade the ganglion cells of the lower esophageal sphincter and the rectum and produce acquired achalasia and acquired Hirschsprung's. Name me. Chagas' disease. Vector, please. Reduvid bug, another name, kissing bug, very good. What's that swelling of the eye sign? Romanus. Okay, what does it do in the heart? It produces myocarditis and chronic heart failure. In fact, congestive cardiomyopathy, I left that one out. And it's one of the more common causes of heart failure in South America, Chagas' disease. Okay, you've seen this already, okay, did you? You did. When we talked about what? Barrett's esophagus. Okay, this is all ulcerated mucosa in the distal esophagus here. This is not. Little tongue, little island. There's Long Island. This is the ocean. Okay, that's all the areas of ulceration. We biopsy along there. What do we see? We see metaplasia. We see glandular metaplasia. We see goblet cells and mucus cells, which shouldn't be there. But they're there because the esophagus can't protect itself from acid injury. Okay, and then what risk do we run? Adenocarcinoma. Of what? The mid-esophagus or distal? See? So if they're talking about a lesion, and talking about dysphagia for solids but not liquids, okay? And they say that a lesion is noted in the distal esophagus. Don't pick squamous cell carcinoma as the cause of that, guys, because that's in the mid-esophagus. If it's distal, what is it? It's an adenocarcinoma. What's the precursor lesion? Barrett's esophagus. Very good. All right. Excellent. Okay. Esophagus. What is that? Veins, guys. What is it? Esophageal varices. So who's the patient? Cirrhotic. Who was? Who has? Cirrhosis and portal hypertension, and I want to know the name of the vein. Left gastric vein. Left gastric vein. Now, if you didn't know that, you better go back to your anatomy notes that Seiden wrote and check the portal vein out, and you'll find out that one of the branches right of the portal vein, right before it goes into the liver, is the left gastric vein. And you'll find out that that drained the distal esophagus and the proximal stomach. What drained into the left gastric vein? The esophagus vein. Well, that comes from further on up. Drained into the left gastric vein, which drained into the portal vein. But because of cirrhosis, the portal vein can't empty its blood as efficiently into it. The hydrostatic pressure increases and you reverse blood flow into the left gastric vein, splenic vein, and other veins, and you end up producing varices, which rupture. What's hematemesis? Vomiting blood. What's hemoptysis? Coughing up blood. What's hematochezia? Blood pouring out of your anus. That's not the same thing as blood coating stool. That's internal hemorrhoids. It's actual dripping of blood coming out. Anybody happen to know the most common cause of that? Diverticulosis, not itis, osis. Why not itis? Because the vessel is right next to the diverticular sac. So if it was itis, it would be scarred off. But osis, it's intact. So all you got to do is erode it. Voila, 600 ml bleed. So make sure you know those terms. Okay, so that's esophageal varices. What's this? It's a tear right at the esophagogastric junction. What's that called? Tear. Mallory Weiss. Let's say this is a young lady. Play odds. Not anorexia. Come on. Bulimia. There you go. Bulimia. Okay? But, you know, usually the classic thing that we all learned in pathology was the alcoholic with retching. Now, you know what retching is? Retching is beyond vomiting. Retching is when you go, and nothing's coming out. Tremendous pressures. So you can tear, have hematemesis, or you can puncture Borjot syndrome. That's when the air starts getting into and all the crap gets into your pleural cavity and starts dissecting up the air, and you get Hammond's crunch in the anterior mediastinum. That's Borjot's. Okay. So you can see this in bulimia, and I believe that's the route they're going now because of the eating disorder thing being so high. They're gonna do Borjot's in the context of a bulimic more so than a retching alcoholic because they know that would give you a tip-off. You may not necessarily be thinking about a bulimic. Okay. Can we just focus this back? I think we made a little... I know that this does better than that. That's worse. Do it the other direction. How about there? Okay. This is esophageal cancer. This is squamous. Okay? That's not the distal esophagus. That's the metesophagus there. In fact, the distal esophagus would be down here. This is squamous cancer. Okay, over here. And so what would the most common cause of that be, please? Smoking second? Alcohol. Very, very good. What do you think the dysphagia would be initially? Solids but not liquids. So here's your board question. 50-year-old man who's an alcoholic has problems with swallowing food but not liquids. Okay? And they say that he has weight loss. Diagnosis? Esophageal cancer. Playing odds? Squamous cell carcinoma mid-esophagus. That's the exact question. Straightforward, no problema. That means no problem. Boy, you really know your Spanish. I do. I'm just very good at it. 1-0, 2-0, 3-0. See, I'm very good at it. 4-0, 5-0. It's funny. I did that I just did it without explaining it. I'm goofing around. I had a whole pile of Spanish-speaking people. Now, Dr. Goy, this is the way it is. 1-0, whatever. I forget. I don't even know what it is. 2-3. And I said, I know. They thought I really thought that that was speaking Spanish. It was really funny, actually. Now, they like this, guys. You want to know why? Because it's kind of like the CT MRI thing that they're going to get. I know one person that, and students have a tendency of exaggerating when they take this test. They say, I had 50 CTs, MRIs, and schematics for my anatomy questions. I think that's probably pushing it. But you know, they like cross sections and stuff like that and identifying structures. So if I were going to do esophageal cancer, I wouldn't use this one. I'd use this slide. Why would I do that? Because I want to see if you know what's what. What's that? What is it? It's the trachea. You can see the cartilage rings right there. Okay? So what's this? That's the esophagus. And what's this? That's an elastic artery. Okay? See, esophagus is right in that middle between the two. And you can see that's completely surrounded by white-looking stuff that seems to be going out there. It's esophageal cancer. That's the one I'd use on boards. This picture is a known pathology slide, and this picture has been on boards. This one's too easy. This is the one they'd use. Okay. This kid, and this is not the treatment for this. This kid is a male, and at 3 weeks of age, started vomiting non-bile stained fluid. You palpated the abdomen, you felt a little knot in the right upper quadrant area, and you looked kind of at the, looked across and looked, and you could see hyperperistalsis. What's your diagnosis? Congenital pyloric stenosis. Now notice I said non-bile stained vomit. Notice I said 3 weeks. Now whatever was duodenal atresia in a Downs kid, okay, that would be at birth vomiting of bile stained fluid. Okay, and then you had the so-called double bubble sign. Do you ever wonder what that double bubble was? I did for a while. Double bubble, what does that mean? Well, the atresia, the lack of development of the lumen, is distal to the where the bile duct comes in. Okay, it's distal to it. And so in other words, bile can still empty into that proximal portion of the duodenum. So that's why it's bile stained. And because there's no movement of anything, there'll be air trapped in there, and then of course there'll be air trapped in the stomach. Okay, and so that will look like a bubble in the stomach and a bubble in that proximal duodenum double bubble sign. So one's in the stomach, one's in the proximal duodenum. Comprende? And also mommy will have polyhedron nails. Okay, so don't confuse duodenal atresia. It's not even remotely the same as the history for congenital pyloric stenosis, which has no relationship to Downs. It does have multifactorial inheritance, so it can be increased in future children, yes. Here's the pyloric stenosis right here. Okay, you can see how thickened the muscle is. So what they usually do is they put a little slit in the belly button, go in there, and just split the muscle. It's called pyloroplasty. That's the end of it. Just opens up. Okay, these are what non-steroidal ulcers look like, or NSAID ulcers, which our friend Trevor probably talked to you about. Remember, the non-steroidals will block PGE2, which is responsible for the mucous barrier of the stomach. Ulcers responsible for vasodilatation of the vessels, mucus secretion, and the secretion of bicarbonate into that mucus barrier. So when you take non-steroidals for any period of time, that whole thing is destroyed. Okay, destroyed. And so you are just sitting duck for ulceration to occur. Okay, and these are little multiple ulcers. And over time, you can get significant blood loss from these things. Now, these ulcers are usually not very deep, maybe just through a little bit through the mucosa, maybe a little bit into the lamina propria. But they're nice punched out things all over the place, and they can cause some bleeding over time. Okay. This is our little friend Helicobacter pylori. Notice that that's a silver stain, so here's another silver stain. So we have Dieterle, silver stain, Legionella, silver stain, pneumocystis, silver stain, Bartonella henslii. Okay, now we have silver stain H. pylori. Now, a good pathologist doesn't need one because they can kind of, they're good at picking up things and they can see them without any special stains, just a plain old H&E. But you can see they're little comma-shaped organisms. That's why they initially thought they were Campylobacter, because Campylobacter is, you know, a comma-shaped organism. But later they turned out that they really didn't have the same cell wall stuff, so now they call them Helicobacter pylori, as opposed to Campylobacter pylori. These are nasty, nasty little dudes. Why? They make urease and lots of cytokines. The urease, of course, is going to convert urea to ammonia, and that's one of the main reasons they can burrow through that mucus layer. Ammonia is very toxic, as you know. That's because it's a urease producer. And that's the way, that's the test that we make use of when a GI person takes a biopsy of the mucosa of the stomach. We do a urease test on it. And if it's positive, then we know Helicobacter is present. Also, you can use serological tests, but that only works the first time. Okay, serologic tests are outstanding. The antibodies against it, but they don't go away, the antibodies, so you can't diagnose recurring disease. It's great for the first time, but after that, it's useless because if you already know they had previous infection, of course, it's going to be positive, so it doesn't tell you dork. Now, we want to make sure that you understand where H. pylori is working. That's why I made a big deal about the parietal cells when we're talking about pernicious anemia and telling you that it was pylorus and fundus, body, not pylorus, fundus and body and fundus. That's where the parietal cells, they're getting destroyed by the autoantibodies against them, an intrinsic factor, and you get an atrophic gastritis in the body and fundus. That's not H. pylori country. H. pylori country is pylorus antrum. Okay, and it destroys that mucosa, produces an atrophic gastritis of the pylorus and antrum, and that's where cancers are. Remember, most cancers are on along the lesser curvature of the pylorus and antrum. That's the exact same place where gastric ulcers are. It's the exact same place where gastric ulcers are located, the lesser curvature in the pylorus and antrum. So this is H. pylori over here. Notice it's living in the mucous barrier. It's been implicated as the most common cause of stomach cancer. And it also can cause malignant lymphomas of the stomach as well. Not the most common cause, but it can do it. But it's low grade. I'm going to show you two ulcers here, guys. Gastric, duodenal. Why don't we ever biopsy a duodenal ulcer? Because they're never malignant. So I'm going to ask you a question. Is that benign or malignant? How many say it's benign? Nobody. How many say it's malignant? Nobody. I guess you don't think it's a gastric ulcer. You think I'm lying. You think I'm kidding, don't you? What I wanted you to say is that it's benign. Okay, and then I would have said, how do you know? See, the only reason they biopsy a gastric ulcer, guys, is because they're trying to rule out whether it's cancer or not. Okay, they know it's an ulcer, so they don't have to prove that it's an ulcer. They just basically biopsy because an ulcer like that has a 3% chance of being a malignant ulcer. So the only purpose of biopsying a gastric ulcer is to see if it's malignant versus benign. But you never have to biopsy a duodenal ulcer because it's never malignant. So you just leave them alone. Why run the risk of a bleed? The more common association of Helicobacter pylori with peptic ulcer disease is duodenal ulcers more so than gastric. Why do you get melena? With upper GI bleeds. Upper GI bleed, by the way, means anything that's a bleed from the ligament arthritis, that's where the duodenum hits the jejunum up. It's considered upper GI. Why is it black? Answer, acid acts on hemoglobin and converts it to hematin. And hematin is a black pigment. So that's why you get melena. That's why it's so important to know that, because if you have black tarry stools, then you have a 95% chance it's an upper GI bleed, and if you play odds, it's duodenal ulcer over gastric ulcer. Understand? Okay, so the black tarry stools is due to the conversion of hemoglobin from the bleeding by acid into hematin, which is the black pigment. Don't forget that. That's a board question. You ever hear vomiting of coffee ground material? What that basically is blood clots that have been acted upon by acid change into hematin, so it does look like coffee grounds. But it ain't. I tried it. It was very, very terrible. That was a joke. I guess that was not good, some of you. I get only people that laugh, probably pathologists. Okay. I have nothing more to say about these ulcers, the peptic ulcer disease. Oh, yes, I do. Got a patient, executive, under great stress, has sudden onset of severe epigastric pain, which radiates into the left shoulder. First step in workup, the patient, please. Flat plate of the abdomen, because he has a perforated ulcer. Odds, duodenal. Why do they have shoulder pain? Because air got out, it settled under the diaphragm, irritated it, which is the fourth nerve, and you got referred pain to the shoulder, which shares the same dermatome. Classic board question. So your first step in management is to do a flat plate, because in 85% of the time you will see air under the diaphragm. That's a part one and part two board question, because they wanted to get into that referred pain thing, knowing about dermatomes and phrenic nerve C4 and dermatomes and where it can spread. Okay? All right, let's break.